Chapter 12. Carisian Embassy, Sidar City, Republic of Sidarmark. "Anything more I should know before our meeting with Gregor and Darius?" Caleb Armok inquired as the gentle breeze flapped the awning. Merlin had given up on convincing him not to perch on rooftops, especially since he was developing an increasingly severe case of cabin fever. Caleb had always hated sending men into battle while he stayed out of the line of fire, and that was getting worse as Carisian troops found themselves in direct combat with the Army of God and its allies. The fact that he could actually see what was happening to those troops through Owl's snarks was simply icing on the cake. It wasn't as if Caleb were deliberately seeking to attract the attention of a potential rifle-armed assassin, so much as the fact that he was spending far too much time in one office or conference or another. Besides, the Emperor was never happy indoors when he could be outdoors, at least when his Empress was somewhere else. The Sage-in had at least prevailed upon his nominal liege lord to allow carpenters to create a proper deck atop the embassy, set far enough back to make lines of fire from street level difficult to come by. In fact, they'd set something of a fashion, with rooftop decks appearing on increasing numbers of townhouses here in the Republic's capital. Sidar City had been larger than Telesburg before the Sword of Shuler. Now the city was more packed than ever with the influx of refugees. There had never been a lot of room for the sorts of landscaped gardens the wealthier inhabitants of Telesburg favored, so perhaps it wasn't too surprising that the city should have begun sprouting additional rooftop decks. They made pleasant vantage spots, especially with the colorful awnings most of their owners had added, although Merlin wondered how well they'd weather the upcoming winter. Sidar City's buildings and rooftops tended to be well coated with grime and soot from coal fires, and he had his doubts about what all of those splendidly varnished or painted decks were going to look like come spring. At the moment, however, the breeze was pleasant, and the view was soothing as Merlin stood behind Caleb's rattan chair and watched the capital's early morning bustle. A bustle which, he knew, only deepened Caleb's awareness of the difference between his own sheltered existence and what was happening in places with names like the Glacier Heart Gap and Thesmar. Under the circumstances, the fact that the Emperor's question had come out in a merely interrogative tone was actually fairly remarkable. "Not really," the Sage-in replied. "I've talked to Narman, and he says there's no surprises in last night's take from the Snarks. Alvarez is being a bit more restrained in conversations with his officers than he was during the attack, though." "He could hardly be less restrained," Caleb pointed out with a smile. "I've known people with an excellent command of invective, but he rose to heights I wouldn't have imagined he was capable of." "Are you surprised?" "No." The smile in Caleb's normally warm brown eyes vanished as they went suddenly cold and bleak. "And satisfied?" "No, I'm not surprised at all." The Earl of Hanth's timing had been impeccable, and the quantity of canister a 30-pounder could spew out was staggering. A 12-pounder field gun fired 30 of the golf-ball-sized shot to an effective range of 300 or 400 yards. A 30-pounder fired 80 of them with an effective range of 600 yards. And at that range, it dispersed that torrent of shot in a pattern 60 yards across, like the devil's own shotgun. The Duke of Harless's leading infantry had been 700 yards from Hanth's entrenchments when the first flare blossomed above them. None had gotten within 100 yards, and casualties had been horrendous. Of the almost 8,000 Desnarian and Dalaran infantry committed to the attack, a third had been killed outright, at least half by artillery fire alone, before they ever entered effective range of the Marines' rifles, and another 3,000 had been wounded. Half of those wounded had been taken prisoner, and almost 300 unwounded men had allowed themselves to be taken prisoner as well, even with those prisoners knowing exactly what the Inquisition was likely to do with such craven traitors if they ever fell back into its hands again. Less than 2,300 had made it back to their own lines unscathed. A casualty rate of over 70% was enough to destroy any unit ever raised, and it would be a long, long time before the devastated regiments could be reconstituted as effective fighting formations. If they could ever be restored as effective formations at all. You know, Harless actually reacted a lot faster than Alvarez gives him credit for, Merlin said after a moment. He got his men massacred, Merlin. I didn't say it was a remotely smart thing for him to do in the first place. I just said he reacted faster than Alvarez thinks he did. Merlin shook his head. He didn't know about the new parachute flares either. So he had a better excuse than Alvarez wants to admit for thinking he could get close enough to rush the parapet under cover of darkness and all that smoke. Not a good excuse, but at least an excuse. And whatever else, he'd realized what was happening and called off the second wave even before the first wave units broke. Caleb looked over his shoulder at the Sage Inn, then grimaced. All right, I'll give you that much. But he should have damned well known better before he sent them in at all. I agree, and Alvarez certainly thinks the same thing, but much as it pains me, we need to be fair to Harless. Oh, Merlin waved a hand as Caleb's eyebrows flew up. I'm not suggesting he's a military genius, but we can't afford to underestimate the other side, and even if he's not in the same league as somebody like Gorthic Nybar or Bishop Militant Barnaby, he may not be as completely feckless as Alvarez thinks he is. He screwed up because of his own prejudices and inexperience, personal inexperience, and it cost him a hell of a lot of men. But he had the excuse that he was inexperienced, which is a hell of a lot more than Catesworth had when he launched that assault on Eastshire, and he learned from it, Caleb. I'm not saying he won't find fresh mistakes to make, but I'll be surprised if he makes this one again, and we need to remember the difference between incompetence born of ignorance and incompetence born of outright stupidity. You're probably right, Caleb said after a moment, looking back out over Siddar City's roofs. I'm not prepared to rule out outright stupidity in his case just yet, though. I'll admit the jury's still out, Merlin agreed. Let's not forget Alvarez's performance, though. That man, at least, is a lot smarter than I thought he was. He's still a stiff-necked, bigoted fanatic who prefers to substitute aristocratic rank for ability and who's likely to allow his thinking to be swayed as much by fervor as logic. He's as ambitious as the next noble, too. And it's obvious he really can hold a grudge until it dies of old age. Earl Thirsk shouldn't be trusting him behind him with a dagger anytime soon, for example. But Desnarian noblemen make his bigotry look like the ravings of a utopian anarchist. Worse, he's demonstrated he can learn from experience, and I really wish he hadn't. I believe you're the one who pointed out that we can't expect the villains to have a monopoly on stupidity. I suppose it follows that we can't expect our side to have a monopoly on competence either. I'm afraid not. And at the moment, given the opportunity, Alvarez would have a hard time deciding who he'd sooner put a bullet into, Harless or a heretic. The longer that goes on, the happier I'll be. In the meantime, Narman and Owl are keeping an eye on them. They'll let us know if anything unanticipated, like a sudden love fest between them, happens. And unless it does, I don't think anyone has to worry about whether or not Howard and Figuera will manage to hold Thesmar. The Sage Inn shrugged. For now, I don't know anything new about the situation there that we could share with the Lord Protector or Parker. Not without getting into those interesting questions we need to avoid, anyway. Caleb's lips quirked at Merlin's dry tone. Gregor Stonar and his ministers had been deeply impressed. Actually, astonished might have been a better word, by the depth and efficacy of the Carisian spy network in the Republic. Delighted, of course, but also a bit miffed by the fact that the Carisians had been able to emplace such an extensive intelligence system without ever being noticed by Henry Maiden's counterintelligence agents. Under the circumstances, they were disinclined to complain, and they were also disinclined to joggle the Carisian's elbow by demanding any details about who their spies were and how they were organized. The Siddharmarkians understood the need to maintain operational security. They'd had conclusive proof of the impressive accuracy of their allies' reports. And the ancient aphorism, "If it isn't broken, don't fix it," had survived among Safeholdian humanity. They would have been even more impressed by the Carizians' intelligence reports if they'd realized those reports were deliberately providing occasionally inaccurate information. Of course, had they analyzed those inaccuracies and errors, they would have discovered the mistakes always had relatively minor implications, although Merlin sincerely hoped they never guessed that they'd been included to prevent them from realizing that Karis's spies were simply too good. And then there was Iva Parson, who'd come to function as a sort of general clearinghouse for the Allies' intelligence reports. Her own net of agents in the Temple Lands provided quite a few of those reports, including information from Zion, where Merlin and Narman remained very hesitant about operating sensor remotes aggressively. And while she held no official standing with the Republic or the Empire, no one in either of those realms doubted her complete and total dedication to the downfall of the Group of Four. Of course, no one in either of those realms thought for a moment that she was putting all of her cards on the table any more than they were either. For example, Merlin found it very interesting that none of Madame Parson's agents, to judge from her reports to Caleb and Lord Protector Gregor, which, according to Al's remotes, weren't always precisely identical to reports from her agents to her, had apparently noticed that half a dozen or so Vickers had died recently under mysterious circumstances. And more power to her, he thought now. She was just as good as Narman Bates when it came to putting together bits and pieces, however, and given that Benjamin Race, Karis's official spymaster, was in far-distant Telesburg, and that Henry Maiden's crushing responsibilities as the Republic's finance minister left him very little time to spend running spy networks, at the moment turning her into the Allies' effective intelligence minister had struck both Caleb and Stonar as perfectly logical. After the fact, at least. It rather amused Merlin that neither of them had even considered making that decision until they woke up one morning and realized they'd already made it. They sure did find all kinds of logical reasons in the end, though, didn't they? He thought. What about Eastshire and Kint? Caleb asked, and Merlin blinked as the question pulled him back up out of his thoughts. I think Stonar and Parker are about as up-to-date on both of them as we could want, he said. Stonar, at least, is a little more nervous about Eastshire's strategy than he wants to admit, but he's on board with it. Which isn't to say he won't be happier when that brigade of his reaches Glacierheart to reinforce Hobson. But Catesworth isn't going to be trying anything aggressive for 5 days yet, at the least, after the way he got his ass kicked up between his ears. And even if he did, Eastshire left enough artillery and enough scout snipers to give him nightmares in that kind of terrain. As for Kint, the turnaround on our semaphore messages to him is barely an hour. That keeps us about as up-to-date as it gets, and so far there's no sign Worsham even realizes he's moved back from Wyvern Lake. He'll be finding out in the next couple of days, when Kint starts sweeping up the Temple Loyalist Militia in Mountain Cross. I'm rather looking forward to that. The Sajin bared his teeth briefly. Those bastards have run up a damn steep tab, and it's past time they got a chance to start paying it back down. Sapphire eyes met equally cold eyes of brown for a moment, and then Merlin shrugged. As I say, everyone's up to date on Glacierheart and Mountain Cross. Certainly up to date enough, there's no point risking someone like Malden or Iva wondering how we get information back and forth at superhuman speed. I think we could reasonably expect another report about Thesmar from Sajin Abraham in about another 5 day, though. That should give us enough time for my mysterious network of Sajins and their sympathizers to get us a message from him. He smiled crookedly. For that matter, if Sajin Merlin can find a reason to be somewhere else, Sajin Abraham could brief us in person. Don't you ever find that a bit confusing? Frequently, actually. Merlin's smile grew even more crooked. Frankly, the hardest bit's remembering what conversations each of my various personalities have had with whom. Caleb chuckled, but then his expression turned rather more serious. Are we burning that candle from too many ends, Merlin? I know it's useful, and I know you were at least half joking just now, but it was a valid point. How many people can you be, How many balls can you keep in the air before you finally drop one and we wind up with something we can't explain away? Merlin grimaced, because Caleb had a point. So far as they were aware, none of the group of four had discovered that Sajin Merlin had visions. They'd been careful to restrict that particular cover story to a very small group of Carizians, despite how useful it had proven. The members of the Inner Circle knew the truth about the network of snarks upon which those visions depended, but they still provided a handy explanation for people like Alfred Hendrick and others who'd been cleared for that story and needed access to the information, but hadn't been included in the Inner Circle. Unfortunately, visions could be almost as unhappy an explanation as the truth if they came to the Inquisition's attention, and Merlin Athrawes had become increasingly visible. Or, rather, the fact that he was more than simply Caleb Armok's most lethal bodyguard had become increasingly evident to the group of four. That had been inevitable, really, although Merlin's prominent part in rescuing Iris and Divan from Delphirok had made it even worse. The Church of God's propagandists had labeled Merlin as Caleb's demon familiar even before that particular adventure, given the Sajin's uncanny ability to prevent assassinations. Yet the Inquisition had carefully not made the accusation openly for years. There had been several reasons for that, including the fact that Jaspar Clinton would have faced the rather pressing problem that, while Mother Church taught that demons existed, she also taught that their appearance in the mortal world would be answered with a divine response, which, unhappily for the Inquisition, hadn't happened. But that reluctance to label him as a demonic presence had changed after the escape from Delphirok provided too much evidence of Merlin Athrawes's superhuman abilities for even the Inquisition to quash. Worse, the increasing evidence of his Sajin spy network clearly proved he wasn't the only Sajin in the woodwork, and that threatened to turn into a serious problem. Both the testimonies and the commentaries made it clear that the original Sajins had fought on the side of the light during the war against the Fallen. Since those same sources made it crystal clear that no Sajin would ever raise his hand against the authority Langhorne himself had bestowed upon Mother Church, he must manifestly be something else. Unless the group of four weren't God's champions after all, of course. Given the alternatives, the Inquisition had made the label official. He could not be a true Sajin. Therefore, he must be the spawn of evil against whom the true Sajins had always fought, and the Grand Inquisitor had solemnly proclaimed that the demon Athrawes was to be slain by any means possible by any faithful child of Mother Church. Assuming, that was, that anyone was willing to get close enough to him to make the attempt. That was undoubtedly the best explanation available to them, although it still left the problem of where his divine opposition was. Merlin expected Clinton and Reyno to use any Carizian reverse as proof that God and the Archangels were taking a stand against Shan Wei's servants. But that was exactly what they'd been doing as the Sword of Shuler drove the Republic towards collapse, and the argument was rather less convincing after the last couple of months. And, of course, remarkably few reformists, and no member of the Church of Caris, paid much attention to Clinton's proclamations these days. Yet a sort of bred-in-the-bone respect for Mother Church's decrees lingered. Merlin suspected that respect gave even Clinton's pronouncements at least a subliminal toehold, even with many who consciously rejected them. That was inevitable after so many centuries of the Church's unquestioned authority, and thereby hung the problem. The many extraordinary abilities tradition assigned to Sajins could cover quite a bit, but there were limits in all things. They really couldn't afford to have people, especially people in critical positions, starting to wonder if perhaps in this particular case Clinton knew what he was talking about. If they did, the damage to the Church of Caris' credibility could be disastrous, for if Merlin was a demon, all the accusations of blasphemy, corruption, perversion, child sacrifice, demon summoning, and Shan Wei worship became damnably more believable. The possibility of one of my personae dropping a ball is one reason I'm glad we're filtering so much of our spy network's reports through Iva these days, he admitted. And thank God Owl's such an accomplished forger. Despite his concern, Caleb chuckled. Over a score of Merlin's informants were now reporting directly to Iva Parson. Every one of them had completely different handwriting, and with Narman looking over Owl's shoulder, the AI had incorporated personal quirks and turns of phrase into each of those agents' writing styles as well. The truth is, Merlin continued, that we're in a better position than ever to feed information from the Snarks to people who need to have it. And it doesn't hurt anything for Iva to be able to share Narman's original written reports with other people either. Which doesn't say a thing about whether or not Sajin Merlin, Sajin Abrem, and Sajin whoever are going to keep their various personalities straight, Caleb pointed out. Not to mention the fact that at least some people are starting to wonder why no one ever realized there were dozens of Sajins running around before you turned up in Old Karis. For that matter, they're wondering where all the rest of those Sajins are, and there's a real limit on the number of them you can give faces to, Merlin. I know. Merlin gave Caleb another of his crooked smiles. Overall, I think the advantages outweigh the disadvantages, though. So do I. But that doesn't mean we don't need to be aware of what those disadvantages are and disaster-proof ourselves against them as well as we can. Agreed. There were times, Merlin reflected, when he had trouble remembering Caleb Armok had turned 26 barely 4 months earlier. That youthfulness helped explain Caleb's impatience and resentment when he couldn't personally lead his navy or army in the field. But Merlin was more than prepared to put up with that as a minor price for the rest of the Emperor's personality. As a general rule, one didn't normally associate the sort of careful analysis and forethought Caleb habitually produced with someone as young as he was, especially since a Safeholdian 26-year-old was barely 24-and-a-half standard years old. For that matter, Charlian was only 28 Safeholdian years old, which was a long way short of ancient and decrepit, now that he thought about it. Perhaps it didn't strike him that way more often because Merlin himself was only 33 years old, subjectively at least. The pika in which he resided was the next best thing to 1,000 years old. People grow up fast on this planet, he thought, especially people like Caleb and Charlian, who don't have much choice about it. Maybe that's one reason I feel so comfortable with them, because God knows Nimmu had to grow up pretty damned fast, too. He snorted suddenly as he realized what he'd just thought. Maybe he really was becoming too many different people? He seemed to be finding partitions between his various personalities in the damnedest places. Lord, I hate to think what a good Bedardist would think if he figured out how many people are running around inside what passes for my brain. What? Caleb asked, and Merlin shook his head. Just thinking about some of the differences between Safehold and the Federation, he said, mostly honestly. You do realize you and Charlian scarcely qualify as gray-haired elder statesmen by the Federation standards, don't you? The thought had crossed my mind, Caleb said dryly. We tend to do a lot of things younger than the Federation did, though. That's exactly what had occurred to me, Merlin grinned. I imagine it's going to occur to Hector and Iris before very much longer, too. No, it's not, Caleb chuckled. They never heard of the Federation, remember? Not that I expect any objections from them, especially Hector. That would require him to be able to think rationally about the subject, and I don't really think thinking is what he's doing at the moment. Mostly, I mean. You're a fine one to talk. I know, Caleb agreed cheerfully, and Merlin laughed. The Emperor had a point, though, he reflected. 18, 16-and-a-half T-years, was the age of majority in most Safeholdian realms. It was 19 in Siddermark, and 20 in the Temple Lands and Coruscant, but 18 was more common. Nor was it unusual to marry even earlier than that, at least among the upper classes. Merlin had been a bit surprised to discover that marrying age among the middle class actually averaged several years higher than among its social superiors, but it made sense when he looked at it. Mother Church discouraged marriages between couples who would be unable to support themselves or their families. That was one reason betrothals lasted as long as they often did. Mother Church was making sure the prospective groom would be sufficiently well established to provide for his bride and the brood of children they were supposed to produce as part of their responsibility to fruitfully multiply. That held as true for yeoman farmers as it did for artisans, merchants, fishermen, and sailors, too. As a consequence, middle-class and lower-class couples tended not to marry until their mid to late 20s. It was only among the very poor, where unions tended to be more informal, and among the relatively wealthy, where the wherewithal to support a family was readily available, that younger marriages were common. And they were commonest of all among the aristocracy, where the provision of heirs, the sooner the better, was one of the overriding reasons to wed in the first place, as the birth of one Princess Alana Armagh demonstrated. I have to admit Gerling's reaction to your and Charlene's terms took me by surprise, Merlin said thoughtfully. He really knocked the opposition to them on the head, didn't he? It looks like he did, anyway. Caleb's tone was cautious. It's only been 7 days, Merlin. There's plenty of time for it to come apart. I agree the Council's not going to balk, but don't forget Parliament has to sign off on it, too. And whose fault is that? Merlin demanded. Ours, Caleb acknowledged. Although, if I recall correctly, you agreed with us. Who am I to argue with experienced, devious, safeholdian Machiavellians? Besides, Narmon thought it was a good idea, too. Which only demonstrates that, dead or not, he can still read politics and diplomacy better than 99% of the human race, Caleb pointed out, and Merlin nodded. The truth was that he'd had his own doubts about Caleb and Charlian's insistence that Carus's terms had to be ratified by Prince Divan's Parliament, not simply by his Regency Council and the Royal Council. After Claremont Gerling's head-on attack, there was little doubt the Royal Council would endorse the Regency Council's decision to accept Carus's conditions, but there'd been no way to predict that ahead of time. That was one reason Charlian had specifically required Divan and his guardians to submit her proposed conditions directly to Parliament, where a small collection of powerful individuals would find it far more difficult to block their acceptance. But that was only one of the reasons, and not the most important one either. And despite his own fears about the political and religious hand grenade a parliamentary debate could turn into, Merlin had ultimately decided she was right. Caleb had agreed with her from the outset, which would have made any of Merlin's objections moot anyway, of course. Merlin was perfectly prepared to advise the Empire's co-rulers when they asked him to, but the ultimate decisions were theirs. In this case, though, the more he'd thought about it, the more he'd come to agree that placing the decision before the entire Parliament, the closest thing Coruscant had to a genuine national forum, for an open, public vote, would cut the legs out from under any charge that a corrupt cabal of ambitious and apostate aristocrats had sold Coruscant to Carus in return for the bribes of personal power and wealth. No one doubted Clinton and the group of four would insist that was exactly what had happened anyway, but the people of Coruscant would know better. Merlin had never disagreed with the desirability of establishing that, but he'd been more than a little worried over how close he'd expected the vote to be. If the margin of approval was razor thin, it would emphasize the shakiness of the new arrangement. Worse, it might inspire those who'd opposed acceptance to resort to extra-legal means of reversing the decision. God knew they'd already seen enough of that in Coruscant, and even if they avoided that, the group of four could be counted upon to argue that, despite all the corruption and all the pressure brought to bear upon the people of Coruscant's representatives, the vicious heretics and servants of evil had been able to muster only a tiny majority to vote in favor of the heretics' blasphemous demands. Assuming, of course, that any true child of God could believe for a moment that the vote count had been honest in the first place. Of course, if Parliament comes through with a strong majority in favor of the terms, it'll provide every single advantage Charlian and Caleb, and Narmon, argued that it would. he thought. And it looks like Gerlings provided just that sort of majority to accept all of them, including Hector and Iris's marriage. I was really afraid that might be the sticking point for a lot of them, but Gerlings' last sermon seems to have put that fear to rest, too. When the Archbishop of Khorasan spontaneously announces from his own pulpit that he's prepared to solemnize the wedding the instant Parliament approves it, that he's not simply willing to, but positively looking forward to it because he's convinced it will be a true marriage of heart and soul, it's just a tad difficult for anyone to argue that Charlian held a dagger to Iris's throat. You do realize Hector didn't expect to be getting married for at least another year or so, he asked. Of course he didn't. But I guarantee he's not going to argue about it, Caleb retorted with a laugh. Didn't you just love his expression when he heard Gerling's sermon? I'll admit the phrase pole-axed came to mind. And didn't Iris look like a cat lizard with a fresh bowl of milk? Caleb shook his head. If I hadn't known better from the Snarks, I'd have sworn she put Gerling up to it. Actually, what made me happiest was how few other people in the cathedral looked unhappy over that sermon, Merlin said more seriously. Admittedly, there weren't many temple loyalists in the congregation, and anyone who was there was probably already inclined to go along with whatever Gerling had to say, but it still struck me as a good omen. It's certainly not a bad one, anyway, Caleb agreed, then cocked his head as the clock tower in Protector's Palace began to chime the hour. We need to get over there, he said, climbing out of his chair. Is there anything else you can think of that we should be bringing up? Not really. Merlin shook his head. That old phrase about sufficient unto the day comes to mind at the moment. Besides, I don't want to suggest anything that could turn this into one of those all-hours meetings you and the Lord Protector seem so fond of. I am not fond of them, Caleb said severely. Although, he conceded in a magisterial tone, the quality of Gregor's beer does go a fair way to reconciling me to the arduous demands of my many weighty responsibilities. Is that what they are? Merlin rounded his eyes, then nodded with an air of sudden understanding. Weighty, are they? That probably explains why you seem so heavy when I end up carrying your semi-conscious imperial carcass back to the embassy afterward. You do not! Caleb said with a laugh, and Merlin sighed. So sad that you're so far gone in drink you can't even remember it. I think we'd better leave this particular topic right where it is, Sajin Merlin, Caleb announced as they started down the stairs. I bow to your tyrannical authority, the Sajin murmured. And so you should. But why are you so concerned about how late I'm planning to stay out consulting with Gregor and Darius? Because I have an errand to run. Merlin's voice was much more serious, and Caleb paused and looked back at him, one eyebrow arched. Today is Narmon and Olivia's anniversary, Merlin said softly. I promised Narmon I'd deliver his anniversary present to her in person. Caleb stood gazing at him for several seconds, then reached out and touched him very gently on the arm. In that case, I promise to be home in time for supper. The Emperor of Khoras told his personal armsman. Chapter 13 Royal Palace, Erastur, Princedom of Emerald, Empire of Khoras.
You know, you really didn't have to deliver this in person, Merlin. Owl's remotes could have brought it to me just fine.
I promised a certain somewhat overweight virtual personality I'd put it into your hands, my very own self. The tall, blue-eyed Sajin smiled down at Olivia Bates on the real-world original of Narmon Bates's favorite balcony. He was fairly insistent. Besides, the smile softened. I'm sort of fond of you myself, you know.
Yes.
The Dowager Princess of Emerald was no taller than her husband had been. She had to stand on tiptoe to kiss Merlin on the cheek.
Yes, I know.
She turned to gaze out over the moonlit waters, and Merlin stood beside her, drinking in the quiet city murmur of a racer and the patient, unceasing voice of the breeze blowing out to sea. He understood exactly why Narmon had always loved this particular vantage point, and the combination of location and design gave anyone standing on it an oasis of near-perfect privacy. Not a minor consideration when everyone knows Sajin Merlin's thousands of miles away in Sidar City, he reflected.
It's still a bit strange, Olivia mused. Having him back, I mean. There are times when all my faith in this newfangled technology reverts back to believing in old-fashioned magic around you, Merlin.
Oh, she waved as if brushing away something only she could see.
I understand the difference between them now. Not the way you do, since you grew up with it, but well enough that I seldom find myself walking around waiting for the Rakurai to come sizzling in the window. But that's not remotely the same as being able to take it for granted, and being able to talk to him, to see him over the comlink, even if I really know it's only Owl generating the image for me. That's magic.
I hope it's good magic.
It's wonderful magic, she said, looking up at him. To be able to talk to him after I lost him forever? I can't think of a greater gift you could have given us, Merlin.
But talking to him isn't quite the same thing, is it? He asked gently. Her head cocked, and he shrugged. As you say, I grew up with technology and computer-generated imagery. I take, or Nimmu Alban took, anyway, that kind of communications for granted. But electronic meetings, calm conversations, were never quite the same as sitting in the same room, talking across the same table, or the same as being able to reach out and touch the person you're talking to.
Of course it's not. Olivia agreed. It's just more than anyone else in the world's ever been given.
She patted the blackened breastplate of an Imperial Guardsman, and her eyes were warm in the lamplight spilling through the glass doors onto the balcony.
Am I human enough to still want more? To wish I could touch him again? Of course I am. But that doesn't keep me from recognizing a magnificent gift when I see it.
I'm glad you feel that way. He put one large, sinewy hand over the far smaller one on his cuirass. Too many things I've had to do, or been able to do, here on Safehold have had double edges, Olivia. I'm glad this isn't one of them. She smiled up at him again, and he reached into the canvas shoulder bag, bearing the emblem of an Imperial courier, which he'd brought with him when the recon skimmer's tractor beam set him soundlessly on the balcony. The package that came out of it was wrapped in brightly colored paper, and Olivia laughed. That paper was the red and gold of emerald, blazoned with the silver flying wyvern of the House of Bates on its dark blue shield. The wyvern was edged in red, making it the personal crest of the Dowager Princess, but the repeating design had been flipped so that images of the wyvern confronted one another, mirror imaging each other in an endless procession, and the wyvern's wings beat steadily whenever the package was moved. No printer on Safehold could have produced that paper, and she shook her head with a huge smile.
You'll have to take the paper with you when you leave, but the crest is a nice touch.
She ran a fingertip over the flying wyverns, and her expression softened.
I wish Narmon Garrett knew his father was still alive, too, and Maria. They miss him.
And he misses them. But one day, after we've kicked the church's butt...
As you say, one day,
Olivia agreed. She hefted the package and raised one eyebrow as she realized how light it was, and how yielding. He made me promise not to tell you what's in it, Merlin told her. But I will tell you that this is something he had Owl whip up especially for you. And Owl had to do quite a bit of research to pull it off, too.
Really?
Olivia's eyes sparkled, and she set the package on one of the balcony's stone tables to open.
Narmon has always loved thinking up presents no one sees coming. I think it's part of the little boy in him. I remember once he spent 5 days meeting with Hal Shander. I thought they had to be working on some kind of deep, dark international plot. Then, on my birthday, I found out he'd had Hal's agents interview my parents' stablemaster to find out which had been my favorite horse as a girl, and then sent an order to the same breeding farm This was 13 or 14 years later, you understand, to get...
She stopped in mid-sentence as the package came open. It contained 2 items, and her fingers were very gentle as she picked up the first one and tilted it to catch the lamplight through the glass door. Golden glory glittered on her palm. The locket was 1 inch across. The golden links of the chain which would support it around her neck were set with small, perfectly cut rubies, and the pendant's face bore her and Narman's interlocked initials.
"It's beautiful," she half-whispered.
"Open it," Merlin said. She looked up at him, then obeyed his invitation, and her lips trembled as she saw Narman looking out of it at her. It was a much younger Narman, standing arm in arm with a much younger Olivia.
"How?"
He had Owl make it from the state portraits the two of you sat for on the first anniversary of your coronation, Merlin replied. He said he thinks they got the colors right.
"Oh, they did. They did."
Olivia shook her head.
"This is so much better than the portraits, though. They're so stiff and formal. We should have commissioned one just like this at the time."
"Then I'm glad Owl was able to help repair the oversight. And if anyone asks where it came from, just tell them he had it made for you and left it for me to deliver as a surprise." Merlin smiled. "It'll even be the truth."
"Thank you,"
she said softly. She gazed at the portrait for several more seconds, then closed the locket, slipped the chain over her head, and turned to the second item in the package. Her eyebrows rose as she lifted the gossamer fabric and held it up against the light. It felt insubstantial as air, yet it was totally opaque. Or it appeared to be, at any rate. Not the slightest gleam of lamplight leaked through it, yet it was curiously hard to determine where its edges ended. Indeed, she could scarcely see it. Even its color seemed oddly elusive and hard to pin down, but it was clearly a garment of some sort, even though she'd never seen anything like it.
"What in the world is this?"
She shook her head with something suspiciously like a giggle.
"I'd have a pretty fair idea of what he had in mind if he were to give it to me himself. Of course, in that case, it would have been a lot more transparent. Besides,"
she looked up at Merlin with a wicked smile,
"he always preferred flattery floaty negligees."
"Somehow I'm not incredibly surprised," Merlin said dryly, and just for a moment Nimmu Alban looked out of those sapphire eyes at Olivia in shared, fond amusement. But then he shook his head, and his expression turned more serious. "Actually, what you have there is a VR suit."
"A VR suit?"
Olivia repeated carefully, and he nodded. "As I said, Narman and Owl had to do quite a bit of research before they could build it. No one's used them in the Federation for a good 70 years before the Gababa showed up, not since we developed direct neural interfacing. So Narman had to reinvent the wheel to figure out how to make it work. And, to be honest, the technology available before we shifted over to the neural interface wasn't nearly as good as what he and Owl put together for this one, even if Owl did have to figure out about 1/3 of it from scratch."
"This is a piece of technology?"
Her tone was dubious, and he chuckled. "Oh, yes. We all know Narman's always been an ingenious fellow when it comes to getting something he really wants. The minor bagatelle of being dead hasn't changed him one bit in that regard."
"But what's it for?"
"Well, as you may have noticed, it has neat little footies and gloves. It opens up the back so you can climb into it. I'll show you how that works. And once you've sealed it again, I'll extrude a hood that covers your head as well."
"That sounds ominous."
She held it up and looked at its opacity again.
"I don't know if I want to wear a blindfold and fall all over the furniture, Merlin."
"Oh, that's not going to happen. What this is, Olivia, is your own virtual reality unit." Her eyes darted from the fabric to his face, and he smiled. "I know it makes steel thistle silk feel like lead, but don't let that fool you. It's riddled with Molly-Circ sensors and biofeedback contacts, and the inside of the hood provides complete audio and visual and olfactory input. And it's tied directly into Owl's CPU, Olivia.
As long as you're wearing it, you can visit Narmon. And you will be able to touch him again when you do. Her eyes glowed, and his smile segued into a grin. Obviously, you can't just wander around in public with a hood over your head, and as I'm sure you've figured out, this is something that needs to be next to your skin. On the other hand, as you and I have both observed upon occasion, Narmon's a devious sort who tends to think ahead, and according to him, the suit's smart fabric will mold to your skin once it's on, and it's programmed to externally duplicate skin coloration and texture. Owl loaded the entire operator's manual into the suit's memory, and you're not going to want to leave it on for any extended periods until you've had the opportunity to read that fully and get used to how it works, if only because of the disorientation that can cause. In fact, the software's governors will kick you back out into the real world if you try to stay in VR for more than a couple of hours at a time. They can be adjusted later, or even turned completely off, but it'd probably be a good idea to leave them until you've got a lot more experience with it. Once you've gotten used to it, you should be able to wear it and use it a lot more freely. Of course, you're going to want privacy while you're working on building that experience. In fact, Narmon suggested to me that I might want to get it to you as early in the evening as possible so you could begin practicing with it this very night. Olivia snorted and rolled her eyes, and he chuckled. On the other hand, he also asked me to tell you that when the suit's deactivated, the hood and the gloves reabsorb into the rest of the suit, which means you can wear it under your regular clothing and turn it off if something comes up that requires your attention while you're using it. The entire shutdown cycle takes less than 3 seconds. And obviously, when you're able to guarantee that you won't have to deal with someone else...
I understand entirely, Merlin Athrawis, she told him firmly. And, bearing in mind that I do, would you mind very much helping me figure out how to climb into this thing, Nimu, and then taking yourself off?
Oh, I think that could probably be arranged, Your Highness. He stood on the balcony, looking out across the moonlit water, listening to the wind while he nursed a glass of wine. It was very quiet, aside from the ceaseless voice of that wind, and he took another sip, thinking about his life, the decisions he'd made, the things he'd done, or not. The compressibility of his transformed existence gave him plenty of time to think, and...
Narmon?
The soft, beloved voice came from behind him, and for just a moment, he froze. Despite all he'd done so that he might hear it once again without the interface of a communicator, despite how desperately he'd longed for this moment, he froze. Unable to breathe, although, to be fair, he really didn't need to breathe any longer, he stood very still, prolonging the moment, the exquisite pain of anticipation. And then, slowly, he turned. She stood on the balcony, just outside the glass door to the suite they'd shared for so many, many years. Her dark hair, lightly streaked with silver, stirred on the breeze. A golden locket gleamed on its ruby-set chain about her neck, and her heart was in her eyes.
Olivia,
he breathed softly, her name almost but not quite inaudible against the background wind song.
Oh, Olivia.
He heard the tremble in his own voice, and he couldn't see her very clearly for some reason. He blinked hard, feeling the tear trickle down his cheek, feeling the thunderous beat of the racing heart death had stilled so many months before, and raised one hand, holding it out to her.
Olivia,
he said one more time, and then she was in his arms, her lips soft and warm upon his own, and the wall between their realities came crashing down. September, Year of God, 896. Chapter 1. Sidar City,
Republic of Siddermark. The weather-battered galleons made their stately way toward the docks and quays lined with silently watching Siddermarkians. The frenetic cheers which had greeted the first wave of Carisian soldiers were muted, and the crowd seemed poised, waiting, without the jagged edge of desperation which had spurred those earlier cheers. The sense of anticipation, of relief, was no less, but the wave of fire and destruction sweeping across the Republic had been halted, or at least stayed, by these men's predecessors. It would have been too much to say that the people of Siddar City felt confident of the war's outcome, but the despair which had hung above the city like smoke had been replaced by determination and something which bade fair to become confidence. Merlin Athrawis stood with Lord Darius Parker and the bevy of senior Siddermarkian officers waiting at Quayside. Emperor Caleb had intended to be there, but he and the Lord Protector had been delayed in a meeting with the Council of Manufactories Stonar had created to rationalize the Republic's contribution to the Allied war effort. From what Merlin could see, courtesy of the Snarks, that meeting was probably going to continue well into the evening. He watched canvas vanishing from yards, saw the spurts of white as anchors plunged into North Bedard Bay's deep blue water. Spacious as Siddar City's waterfront was, it could berth only a tithe of the transports, far less their escorting warships, and large oared lighters were already heading out to meet the others. The oar-powered tugs fussed around the closest galleons, nudging them toward the quays, and the Republic's seneschal stirred beside him as Parker recognized the standard of a Carisian general officer flying from the lead ship's mizzen peak. Fenders squeaked and groaned as the galleon nuzzled ponderously against them. Mooring cables went aboard, tension was taken, and the gangplank ran out from the dockside. There was silence for a moment, broken only by the waterfront sounds which never completely stopped, the cries of birds and wyverns, the endless, patient slapping of waves and water, the background of workmen's voices, the crackling pop of flags and command streamers. Then a stocky, gray-haired man in the still bizarre-looking camouflage-patterned field uniform of the Imperial Carisian Army, with the golden sword of a general on his collar, came down the gangplank, followed by a very young, golden-haired army captain and a grizzled-looking colonel. The quiet held until the general's boot touched the stone of the quay, and then the regimental band at the seneschal's back burst into music. The music was high, fierce, and wild, rising on the skirling voice of the war pipes, founded on the percussion of the Republic of Siddermark Army's deep-voiced drums, and the name of that song was The Stand at Carmick Crossing. The march written by Francis Kaisi 110 years before to commemorate the 37 Pikes' epic stand in the Battle of Carmick. The cheers which had hovered unvoiced burst free as the gathered civilians and officers recognized the defiance of that music, for the 37th Infantry Regiment, heir to the 37th Pikes' battle honors, had stood just as valiantly in the Silmon Gap this very year, stood in the teeth of rebellion, mutiny, and treason, stood in the face of atrocity and massacre, stood amid the bodies of its fallen, stood until it was no more than a colonel, a captain, and a single understrength company, stood until the Republic's allies had stormed to its rescue and driven the army of God back up the gap like a hurricane from the sea. No one on that waterfront could miss the meaning of that music, and they rolled up upon its wings, those cheers, waves of sound beating at the heavens, as Darius Parker stepped forward under the bright September sun to exchange salutes and then clasp Alan Simpkin's forearm firmly. The lamps burned in weary eyes as efficient servants filled the various glasses, tankards, and steins. The Republic of Siddermark, Merlin Athrawes reflected, was the only mainland realm where an emperor, the elected ruler of almost 130 million people, half a dozen generals, all but one of them of common birth, a lowly major, the wealthiest banker in the entire republic, two foundry owners, the Grand Master of the Gunmakers Guild of Sidermark, and an industrial expert who'd never known his father's name, could sit around a table littered with maps, charts, dispatches, the ruins of sandwiches and salads, fried potato slices, overflowing ashtrays, and their choice of beer, wine, or whiskey. The mere thought of the highest of the high rubbing elbows with such plebeians in a rolled-up-sleeves conference would have sent any mainlander aristocrat storming out of the room. And that fact was one of the many reasons Sidermarkians and Carisians got along so well, and why those other mainland realms should tremble in fear.
"I don't know about you, Your Majesty,"
Gregor Stonar said, pinching the bridge of his nose and leaning back in his chair,
"but I'm exhausted. Of course,"
he lowered his hand and smiled at Caleb,
"I'm also a rather older man than you are. No doubt my endurance isn't what it was once."
"Your endurance seems to be doing just fine, my lord," Caleb grinned. "Not that I'm above pretending I'm only deferring to your advanced decrepitude when I graciously agree to stagger home to bed, you understand. I believe it's called diplomacy."
Stonar snorted, and laughter muttered its way around the table.
"With your permission, Your Majesty, I'll admit I'm looking forward to a bed that doesn't move tonight myself. Sailing beats the Shan Wei out of marching, but it wasn't the very smoothest passage in the history of the world,"
Alan Simkin said, with generous understatement, considering the stormy weather the troop convoy had encountered. Then he laid one palm flat on the marked-up map in front of him.
"And at the moment, my brain's fair bursting with all that's been crammed into it, come to that."
"Yours isn't the only worn-out brain at this table, General," Darius Parcare said wryly.
"Mind you, I think it's been worth it." "Yes, it has." Stonar's tone was much more serious. "It's been very much worth it, assuming it all works." "With all due respect, my lord," Henry Maiden corrected gently, "if even half of it works, it's been entirely worth it."
Stonar looked at him for a moment, then nodded.
"A valid point, Henry, and I agree entirely. I suppose it's a bit greedy of me to want all of it to work."
"After last winter, my lord," Caleb snorted harshly, "I don't think it's unreasonable to expect things to even out. Your people have stood up to attack on a scale the world's never seen, never imagined. There's not another mainland realm that could have survived something like the Sword of Shula, and everyone around this table knows it. I think we owe your citizens a little something for that kind of fortitude, and we damn well owe Clinton's butchers a little something on their behalf. I'm looking forward to making a rather large down payment."
The sound that went around the table this time was much colder, Merlin thought. Colder and hungry. And well it should be. I suppose the canal raid could be considered a down payment, and so could what's happened in the Silmon Gap and the Glacierheart Gap. But much as we may have hurt them there, we still haven't hurt them anywhere nearly as badly as they hurt Sidermark over the winter and spring. Despite what Eastshire did on the Divan, we're still playing defense. It's past time we found a way to make them dance to our tune for a while, and these are just the people to make that happen. He looked around the chamber, under the canopy of pipe smoke drifting about the age-blackened rafters, and considered all that had been crammed into the minds of the men in it. Another thing that set Sidermark apart from the rest of the mainland and underscored its kinship with Karis was the fact that the generals seated around the table hadn't turned a hair when they found civilians seated with them. And not simply civilians. Even the most senior of officers occasionally had to accept that civilians would have a voice in their deliberations if the civilians in question happened to be their political masters. But these civilians were merchants, bankers, and even mere artisans who worked with their hands. Those were the civilians who got their orders after the great and the powerful had decided what was to be done, and their function was to obey those orders, do as they were told, and otherwise keep their mouths shut. It certainly wasn't to argue or make excuses about why it couldn't be done. Even in Siddermark, the degree of input the Lord Protector's Council of Manufactories enjoyed was a distinct departure from previous practice, but the Siddermarkian social matrix had made it easier for him to create it. And the fact that, in yet another similarity with both Old Carus and Chisholm, the Republic of Siddermark Army had traditionally drawn the majority of its officer corps from the middle class helped enormously. Stonar had selected Timon Quentin, head of the House of Quentin, Siddermark's great banking dynasty, to head his council. The Quentin banking empire had been brutally wounded by the sword of Schuller and the collapse of traditional trade patterns. Timon had to be even better aware of that than Merlin was, yet he'd unhesitatingly placed his contacts, his connections, and his personal wealth at the Republic's service. It was quite possible he'd ruined himself and his family in the process, although no one would have guessed it from his expression or manner. On the other hand, he didn't know, yet, that Edward Houseman was about to make a major investment in the House of Quentin. That investment made good, hard business sense, and Quentin's contacts would open countless doors in the Republic for Houseman both during and after the present war. But it was more than that as well. A way for the Carisian Empire to repay a portion of its debt to the one mainland realm with the courage and fortitude to stand beside it in the teeth of the Inquisition itself. The other senior members of the Council of Manufactories present were Jacques Harriman, Eric Adams, Bartholom Edwards, and Iva Parson. The white-haired, rather frail-looking Harriman was an old friend of Henry Maiden's. He was also the ironmaster to whom the Chancellor and the Lord Protector had turned for the limited number of rifles they dared to order before the Sword of Schuller. He'd also been equally clandestinely experimenting with the new model artillery, in the process of which he'd acquired a new business partner in the form of Iva Parson. The combination of her investments in Harriman's foundry, in Siddermarkian mining properties in Glacier Heart and Mountain Cross, and in two of Siddar City's four major shipyards, went far towards explaining her membership on the council, although her role as the Allies' spy mistress had a little something to do with it as well. Eric Adams was a junior partner of Harriman's. At 56, he was 16 years younger than his widowed associate, with sandy brown hair, gray eyes, and broad shoulders. A fervent reformist, he was quick-witted and quick-moving. In many ways, he reminded Merlin of a somewhat older Edward Houseman, and he showed a fierce interest in acquiring the latest Carisian industrial techniques, not just because he recognized how badly the Republic's army needed those capabilities either. No, he was looking forward to the end of the war as well, and he clearly wanted to build a robust Siddermarkian industrial base to compete with Carisian supremacy. He was being rather discreet about it, and Merlin wondered how he would react if he discovered Caleb and Charlian Armok were simply delighted by the notion of mainland competition. Within reason, of course. A man as smart as Adams would almost certainly figure that out in the end, although it was unlikely he'd realize what actually motivated his Carisian ally's attitude. Despite the way in which Safehold's economy had grown in size and sophistication over the last century and a half, many of its thinkers remained firmly mired in the concept of what had been called mercantilism on old Earth. It wasn't exactly the same sort of mercantilism, given the huge differences in the population patterns and the fact that every enclave on Safehold had begun with exactly the same technology base. The basic ideas of protectionism and the creation of fixed trading relationships, closed to outside competition, had been part of the Safeholdian matrix for a very long time, however. That was, in fact, the basis for a great deal of the pre-jihad resentment of Carus's industrial and maritime power. The notion that an empire whose dominance in those areas bade fair to become absolute might actually favor free trade and competitive commerce from an economic perspective would take some getting used to. The fact that the entire purpose of the present war was to subvert the technological stasis created by the Church of God awaiting and that spreading the new technologies as widely as possible was the best way to do that would remain Karras's little secret for as long as possible, hopefully even from a smart cookie like Adam's. For the moment, any such suspicion was the furthest thing from Adam's mind as he and Harriman sat on either side of Brigham Carter, Edward Hausman's envoy to the Council of Manufactories. Carter and his support staff had arrived only last 5 day, bringing with them crate loads of technical drawings, manuals, and working models. Carter himself was a stocky, powerfully built man in his early 40s, with typical Carisian coloring and the scarred hands of a fatherless boy who'd begun as a sweeper in one of Ryan McHale's manufactories when he was barely 10 years old. In many ways, he and Hausman had both been mentored by McHale, and it was no accident he'd been chosen for his present position, although the thought of how a Desnarian, or even a Dalaran, might have reacted to taking instruction from a mongrel whose speech still bore an echo of his guttersnipe origins beggared the imagination. In Sidermark, however, the reaction had been quite different, and Quentin, Adams, and Harriman couldn't have cared less how he spoke. And then there was Bartolom Edwards, possibly the most interesting member of the council. About midway between Adams and Harriman in age, Edwards was the head of the Gunmakers Guild in Old Province. That made him, effectively, the senior member of the guild in the entire Republic, and he was the man Harriman had tapped to assemble the gunmakers who constructed the rifles Stonar and Iva Parson had ordered from him. He was also the one man at that table whose entire professional life was about to be destroyed by the changes the Council of Manufactories was busy midwifing. The innovations Karras had already introduced into its own industrial sector, much less the ones Hausman was even now putting into effect, made that as inevitable as the rising of the sun. The days of highly paid, skilled artisans assembling firearms, or anything else, one handmade piece at a time, were numbered and dwindling quickly, and Edwards knew it. Yet even though his reformism was less fervent than Adam's, Bartolom Edwards was a fierce Sidermarkian patriot, loyal to his Lord Protector and his Constitution, with boundless contempt for the traitors who'd betrayed both. And on top of that, he was smart. Smart enough to see the changes coming and recognize that the guilds would have no choice but to adapt. Indeed, to disappear. Trying to fight those changes would be as fatal as trying to swim across North Baydard Bay. So, like a skilled seaman in the face of the tempest, Bartolom Edwards would ride the winds of revolution and innovation and encourage his fellow guildsmen to do the same. The new manufactories would require large numbers of experienced supervisors, and that was exactly the role into which Edwards meant to slot as many members of his guild as could see the writing on the wall. Some of them, too many really, for Merlin's peace of mind, were apparently blind to that writing, and he didn't like to think about what was going to happen to them and to their families when the future came calling. Nor did he like to think about what might happen if they and others of like mind dug in their heels and tried to resist that future. At least some of them were going to, and when that was coupled with the inevitable disruptions of a truly industrialized economy, the consequences would be ugly. And maybe not just here in the Republic, either, he thought grimly. There's always those idiots in Chisholm to worry about, too. But no one at this meeting questioned the necessity of embracing the new techniques as rapidly as possible, just as every one of them understood how dependent the Republic's military options and fate were on the efforts of the Council of Manufactories and their Carisian allies. The total pre-war output of every gunsmith in Sidermark would have sufficed to build just over 4,000 rifles per month. Harriman and Edwards had found ways to significantly improve production rates in Old Province, but even there, in the Republic's most populous single province, and even with the influx of refugees, which had included many of the surviving gunsmiths from provinces which had gone over to the Temple Loyalists, production was barely 1,000 per month, They could probably increase that to as much as 1,500, but it wasn't going much higher as long as the Republic retained the Gunmakers Guild's traditional processes. Worse, the numbers were far lower for the other loyal provinces, not simply on an absolute basis, but in proportion to their population, because Harriman and Edward's arrangements had yet to be duplicated outside Old Province. At the moment, the entire Republic was doing well to produce 4,800 rifles per month. That meant the 80,000 Carizian muzzle-loading rifles handed over to Darius Parker's regiments as the Carizian Expeditionary Force re-equipped with Mondrains represented 17 months, almost 2 Safeholdian years, of the Republic's current production, and 18 of the new Sidermarkian rifle brigades. So, yes, Gregor Stonar and his generals knew exactly how important the Council of Manufactory's input into military decisions had become.
"I'm thinking we'll be in a fair way to making that down payment for you, Your Majesty,"
Simkin said. The general took a long pull from his beer and thumped the stein back down on the tabletop.
"Mind you, I'd be a mite happier if His Grace had waited until we were actually here before setting off for Fort Tyrus. But he's like a cat lizard. Fling him any which way you like, he's a way of landing on his feet. Truth to tell, he and Baron Greenvalley are a lot alike that way. And I do like what His Grace has in mind for those bastards in the South March."
"I can't argue with you there, General," Maiden said, but his expression was troubled, and he snorted when Stonar quirked an eyebrow at him. "I agree that Duke Eastchair has his eye on the prize, my lord, and if he can actually pull it off, those motherless Desnarians are going to think they're back in the middle of our last war. I just find it difficult to convince myself that even Desnarians are going to let us get away with it."
"That's because you've been watching the Army of God and the Dalarans, not the Desnarians, my lord," Merlin said. "For all their other flaws, the Dalarans have at least some appreciation for the potential of amphibious operations, and Catesworth tried hard to scout Duke Eastchair's position on the dive-in before he ultimately attacked. He didn't manage it, but he tried, and everything we've seen out of Worsham indicates he understands the need for aggressive scouting. And even more important, both of them actually try to confirm the reports they get from Temple Loyalist sources. Desnair doesn't really have any concept of amphibious operations, and we all know how poor Desnarian logistics have traditionally been. The fact that the Church is helping manage their supply arrangements this time doesn't seem to have changed their internal grasp of the problem's realities, and I think they persist in viewing galleons and blue water transport as simply barges, which may be a bit larger than most of the ones they're used to. And as far as figuring out what Duke Eastchair is up to, Duke Harless doesn't have any idea how good our spies and scouts are, or rather, of how bad his are in comparison to ours."
"The Sejin's right, Henry," Parker put in. "For all the Desnarians' love affair with horses, they've never understood the function of scouts the way we have, and there's no indication they've fixed that problem this time around either." He shook his head. "They've got a fair grasp of how to use cavalry screens to hide what they're doing, but they've never made proper use of their light horse to figure out what we're doing. They ought to have regiments out on sweeps, preferably as much as 100 miles in every direction, and according to our reports, they're barely 20 miles out. Beyond that, they seem to be relying on reports from Temple Loyalists, and as Ivers demonstrated," he nodded courteously in Madame Parsons' direction, "they don't seem to grasp that not all of those Temple Loyalists are quite as loyal to the Temple as they profess."
"And unlike Worsham, at least," Ivor put in, "Harless puts very little effort into confirming or disproving those Temple Loyalists' veracity." She smiled whimsically. "As nearly as we can tell, his measure of reliability is very simple. If the reports confirm what he already thinks, they must obviously be accurate. Whereas if they don't..."
She shrugged eloquently, and several of the others chuckled appreciatively. "Even better." Caleb's smile was far more wicked than Iva's. "Where the southern jaw's concerned, the best cavalry screen in the world won't help them."
"All very well for you, Your Majesty," Simkin said. "You're not going to have to explain to my lads why so many of them are turning around cat-lizard in pan to go straight back aboard those ships.
I would, of course, General, Caleb assured him, except for the need to maintain operational secrecy. Given that paramount consideration, I don't see how we could possibly allow anyone but you yourself to break that, I mean, to give them that news. His general gave him a somewhat skeptical look, and Stonar hastily raised a wine glass to conceal something closer to a grin than a smile. Given the number of Temple loyalists here in the capital, there's no way to prevent Catesworth and Worsham, at least, from learning that General Simkins arrived, Ivor said. I'm sure there are messenger wyverns headed for their headquarters right this minute. I think it may be possible to prevent them from realizing that 4th Brigade's re-embarked, though. Merlin gazed at her thoughtfully. Thanks to Owl's snarks, he knew she was correct about those messenger wyverns, and a part of him was tempted yet again to steer her counterintelligence teams to the people sending them. In fact, he and Narman had done precisely that where the more effective and efficient spies were concerned. The ones who were left provided too much information to the Army of God's field commanders for his peace of mind, but much of their information was wrong, or even better, grossly exaggerated. Not only that, but duplicating the Iron Curtain he and Benjamin Race had drawn around Old Karras for King Harald would have been impossible in Sidermark. There were simply too many ways for spies and their messengers to slip in and out of cities when they didn't need boats to report back to their masters. Given that it wasn't feasible to shut them down completely, he agreed wholeheartedly with Iva's ploys to manipulate the information available to them. Dummy encampments, wooden cannon, false shipping orders, covered ammunition barges loaded with rock ballast, and infantry regiments which marched west in the morning, then circled around to their starting points to march past again the next day, all helped to convince Catesworth and Worsham that the forces facing them in Westmarch and the Silmon Gap were being heavily reinforced, when, in fact, the reverse was true. Meanwhile, she and Parcare had established a tight security cordon around the major encampment on East Point on the far side of Unity Strait, the channel connecting Baydard Bay to North Baydard Bay, from the city. Anything they really wanted to keep out of the Temple Loyalist spies' sight was normally tucked away at East Point, and the Carisian 4th Infantry Brigade could easily be shifted there as part of the capital's garrison. You're thinking about lightering them back out aboard ship from East Point in the middle of the night, aren't you? That's exactly what I'm thinking, Sage and Merlin, she smiled. And I'm also thinking it would be very helpful if Brigadier Matheson could leave a few of his men behind, just enough to be visible here in the city in their uniforms on a semi-regular basis, you understand?
I've always admired a cunning mind, Madame Parson, Simpkins said with an answering smile. And there's always a few sick or injured in a force this size. I imagine the Brigadier and I shouldn't find it so very difficult to come up with a score or so of warm bodies.
His smile grew a bit broader.
For that matter, we've quite a few spare uniforms, and they do say it's the clothes as make the man, don't they?
I do believe I've heard that, General, she agreed, and raised her glass to him. Merlin joined the chuckle that answered the exchange. He doubted Iva's subterfuge would hold up indefinitely, but it was likely to work long enough to at least thoroughly confuse anyone on the other side. He turned his head to gaze at the huge map hanging on one of the conference chamber's walls. The flag-headed pin showed the latest information on all of their own forces and most of the enemies. At the moment, there was one very large Carisian flag stuck into the dot representing Sidar City, but that was going to be changing.